After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Real Change series on the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg. Inspired by Sharon's newest book, Real Change, this series features conversations with activists, artists, and teachers, all discussing the intersection of meditation and social action. To learn more, visit realchangebook.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm speaking today with Mark Solomon. Mark is a nationally recognized political strategist and campaign leader. With 25 years of experience in strategy, campaign management, policy development and execution, messaging and communications leadership, and field mobilization, Mark has a deep track record of assembling winning bipartisan campaigns on the most challenging issues. He was one of the key architects of the marriage equality movement and has applied lessons from the marriage equality movement to help secure impactful criminal justice reforms, pass laws enacting automatic voter registration, advance pro-immigrant policies, and build bipartisan support for ending partisan gerrymandering. For the last 2 years, Mark was a key strategist on Florida Amendment 4, the successful ballot campaign to restore the ability to vote to people convicted of felonies. He's also the author of the book, Winning Marriage, the inside story of how same-sex couples took on the politicians and public and won, which was named a best book of 2014 by Slate Magazine. Welcome to the Metta Hour, Mark.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So talking to you or even thinking of you, I think about the year 2000 when we met at the Insight Meditation Society during the three-month retreat that was being held there. And of course, it was a strange year in so many ways. And what we do during U.S. presidential election years when there's an intensive retreat going on like that is the next morning, the morning after the retreat, we put a folded up piece of paper on the bulletin board, which is like the hub of, you know, all things at a retreat. And we put this folded up piece of paper on the outside. It says, "For those who are interested in the results of the U.S. presidential election, please pick this up." And then the winner's name is in there. So that year, at night when I was going to bed, it looked like George Bush had won. And I woke up in the middle of the night and it looked like Al Gore had won. And then I woke up in the morning before going over to the retreat center and it said, "We don't know who won." So that's what we put on the inside of the piece of paper. "We don't know." And meanwhile, people have been meditating intensively in silence for like a month or maybe even a little more at that point. And so people who came in for what we call interviews, just these short meetings where you describe your meditation practice and you get some feedback, they were kind of spaced out. And they were like, "Don't we usually know the next morning?" And I said, "Yeah, we do. But there's something very strange going on." And you were the person there who had the most experience in government in that world. And you just knew how strange it was. So it brings it all back, just having you.
I was freaking out. I think over the course of several days, this went on. They finally announced the the winner of that race on the last day of the retreat. So as we were let back into the world. And, but I remember looking about three times and it still said that we don't know, we don't know. I remember asking you, Sharon, in this 10 minute interview, we were really supposed to talk about your practice. I was like, Sharon, I'm dreaming. I'm this, and you're like, Mark, I remember you said, Mark, I'll tell you. And I was like, I don't think I want to know. I think it'll just cause me to, my brain to just keep spinning even more. So,
well, you came to us from the halls of Congress. Is that right? You were working.
Yeah. There? Yeah. I worked for a senator, for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. So I do think of you because, you really did know how very, very off it was. Here we were.
Yes. Yes. I had all sorts of scenarios in my yogi mind. So for sure.
So how did you end up coming to IMS?
You know, I had been going through a challenging time in my life, and that I was coming out of the closet, and I was sort of a late bloomer in coming out of the closet. I'd worked on Capitol Hill for a while, and I took a job in the senator I worked for, moved back to his home state, which is my home state of Missouri, and I moved with him to help him with some of his advocacy work back home. And then I just, as I was coming out, I just decided I needed a total break from what I was doing. And I decided to go to the Kennedy School at Harvard to get a master's degree in public policy. And I got there and I was like, it just felt like the same sort of rat race that I'd been in, just in a different context. And so I remember it was on Rosh Hashanah, I remember going to the beach and getting Larry Rosenberg's book on meditation and sitting there. And I started going to Cambridge Insight Meditation Center the next morning and just found that what I really wanted to focus on was on love and loving kindness and connection, and that it was something I wasn't going to learn in the U.S. Senate, and I wasn't going to learn it at Harvard either. So... And so I eventually, I took your class. I had to sort of make my strongest case to get off the waiting list and into a week-long meta course that you were teaching. And it was totally transformative. And after that, I, took all my stuff and threw it in storage and took the next year off and just spent half of it in retreats and half of it backpacking around the country. And it was quite a year.
It's so interesting because, for so many people, especially people kind of in the world, working hard in the world and trying to affect change, the word love is not that appealing in a way, it often is equated with weakness or giving in or using one's edge, but you seem to have an immediate kind of spark for that.
Yeah, it wasn't on the on the syllabus at the Big H in Cambridge. So I had to go somewhere else.
Yeah, but you wanted to, which is kind of amazing, as an activist.
Yeah, it was really, what I learned. It was the practice of love and kindness was instantly so powerful to me as somebody who, I didn't come out of the closet as a gay man until I was 30 years old. And so I was keeping this, this part of myself secret from everybody. Like, I didn't come out of the closet. I didn't share that information with anybody other than a couple of therapists, no friends, no family. And so it was, I was really feeling, I felt like this part of myself could not be lovable. And if this part of myself was known to the world, I wouldn't be lovable. And so the notion of finding that somewhere on, you know, beneath my fears and self-doubt and self-hatred, and that there was sort of this light of metta, of love and kindness that was burning brightly, that I could sort of shine on myself and on others, was like the, you know, among the most important discoveries I've made in my life. So I'm, that's why, you know, I think the book that I've read the most, the book that I've read the most in my life is your first book, Love and Kindness, shared the most with others. So it's, it really changed my life.
Wow. Well, thank you. I'm so glad. This is the 25th anniversary of the year it came out, which is kind of remarkable.
Yeah. That is amazing.
So one of the themes from the book, Real Change, that I'm exploring also in this podcast series, which, by the way, is named Metta, M-E-T-T-A. Not everyone knows that because they just hear Metta. Metta, M-E-T-T-A, is the Pali word, language of the original Buddhist text, for loving kindness or love. So, but some of the themes I'm exploring in the book are around anger and rage and the ways they can propel us to action and the ways they can burn us up. So can you tell us a little bit about your own personal journey with anger?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I remember during that 3-month retreat in Barrie is when I really, you know, uncovered a lot of so much anger and rage at myself, at my family, at the sort of the conditions that led me to stay in the closet and keep this aspect of myself hidden for so long. And, you know, I know a lot of people have this notion that you go to a long meditation retreat and you discover the learnings of the Buddha in a blissful sort of way. And that was never my experience. It was like anger, rage, and it was exhausting looking at it and I remember some of the teachers told me, you know, don't stare at these mind states for 15 hours a day. You need to pace yourself. I think what I've been able to do with them is to, or what I understand is that, and get in a sort of visceral way, is that there is something beneath those feelings, those difficult emotions and feelings, and that is this notion of connection and love. And it doesn't mean that that's what's, you know, sort of prominent much of the time, but it's just having experienced being in touch with that feeling and of love and connection meant for me that even when I'm feeling angry and disconnected, and you know, I knew that that there was something better.
I'm so glad you said that, because I think part of what makes us feel the most hopeless or broken in a way is when we don't feel there's anything intact, you know, that it's all fallen apart. And in the new preface for this book, Real Change, I got to write a preface because the publication date was delayed. And it was delayed because of the pandemic. And of course, the whole book was written before the pandemic.
Right.
And somebody was reading it and suggested that I try to give some context for our time. And so I wrote this preface. And part of what I said in the preface was that word is that after the atom bomb dropped in Hiroshima, there was even further psychological devastation because there was a rumor that the grass and the trees would never grow again. So it's like even nature was just broken and severed. And that as horrible as the suffering was after the bomb, once people were reassured that in fact the grass and trees would grow again, then there was a much greater ability to go on. So I think we count on something being intact, you know, even when things are terrible and cruel and awful, there's something that we can actually count on.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So across your career, you've faced many losses in your work. And I know that Proposition 8 prompted you to relocate from Massachusetts to California even. So how does one recover from those kinds of setbacks? Like, where do you look for resilience?
Yeah. Look, any serious social movement of any sort has plenty of losses, and you're likely to lose a lot at the beginning. And it's interesting. In the marriage equality movement that I was a part of for 15 years, initially, when I first got involved, so many people said to me, you're never going to win. There's no chance. This is impossible. Why are you even bothering? The Catholic Church is going to crush you. And this was including a number of LGBT people felt that way. And then at the end, when we got close to the end, at least, and it looked like things were really going our way, people were like, "Well, this is happening on its own. This is inevitable." And so it was a great lesson to me that both impossible and inevitable have something very deep in common, and that is that it allows you to not do anything. If you're sort of sitting on the sidelines saying this is never going to happen, it's impossible, don't get your hopes up. Or if you're sitting on the sidelines saying it's going to happen on its own, where my focus has always been is on the work of trying to help bring something that lots of people think is impossible to a place where it is close to inevitable. But and over the course of that sort of period, there are plenty of losses. For me, on the issue of marriage equality, I was always so inspired by, I was inspired by my own feeling, my own quest of wanting to have the opportunity to get married, and sort of going through my, late 20s, early 30s, where a number of my friends, straight friends, got married, and I was fortunate to be, to be in their weddings and be a groomsman or a best man, and seeing how, and having the sort of mixed feeling of just so happy for them, and but also feeling that this was something that wasn't available to myself, and that my own love was not appreciated. And then as I got in this move, as I sort of entered into this movement, what I was just inspired by the notion of kids, young LGBT people, and who could have a different vision of their life. And also I was inspired by older couples who had been together for 40, 50 plus years, who had lived through so much of, so much discrimination and physical and emotional violence. And so they really kept me going. It's the vision of these kids and the vision of, holding these kids and these seniors in my own experience helped me sort of pick back up and keep going. It wasn't always, it wasn't always easy at all. Prop 8, which you mentioned, was a really especially tough one. I will never forget being in the Proposition 8 headquarters in November of 2008. And it was like the world around us was rejoicing because Obama had been elected president, and yet the people of California, perceived as one of the most progressive places in the country, voted to take away gay people's ability to marry, and felt like we were really, really second-class citizens at that point. And people forget that even you know, back then, even Barack Obama was opposed mm-hmm. to gay people being able to marry. So that's all part of what a social movement is. And we, you know, we picked up after that loss, and we, you know, there was plenty of grieving, but it also brought forth a whole new generation of activists who, you know, who were ready to roll up their sleeves and go to work.
And in the midst of like the struggle or the long-termness of it with the losses, does it feel like it's difficult to also take joy in the wins? I know that you have some quotes in the book Real Change about that very thing. Like, you wanted to put like even one small win on the table every day.
Yeah, it's so. The way to break it down, you know, for a long fight, a long civil rights battle, is to, and this at least this is the way my mind works, is, you know, I need to be able to see some level of forward movement. So it's like, what can we accomplish this day, this month, this year that is demonstrating forward progress, even if we're going to lose 7 ballot initiatives in states and we're, you know, et cetera. So is it getting somebody who's unexpected, you know, a prominent business leader to come out and support and write an op-ed piece? Or is it getting, you know, having a 5% increase in polling? So it's in a state. So, or getting a marriage bill to, you know, through a committee. So it's figuring out ways to break a social movement down, you know, into bite-sized pieces so that we always can have some place to focus, and we don't judge our wins in, you know, on a daily, weekly basis and, you know, in a too sort of critical manner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, I think it always seems like it's not enough, right? Or what we can affect in one action is just never enough, and yet how do we keep going? You know, how do we find resilience? We have to learn, I think, to actually take in the joy as well.
Yeah, and so it is. It's definitely taking in the joy, and it's also, you know, I would always or you know often hearken back to this. You know, who am I, you know, who am I fighting for? And you know, I think about some of these, you know, gay elders who have been at it for, you know, for decades, and these things don't happen all at once. And, you know, I look at their resilience and, you know, I remember this one couple in particular, a gay couple in Boston, and I got to know them. They started marching in the Pride parades in Boston Pride, and they carried a sign. The first time I met them, they carried a sign that said 47 years together. And so we introduced ourselves, and, you know, it was like, you know, really remarkable. And then I got to know them, and, you know, eventually they, you know, Massachusetts, of course, was the first state, and eventually they carried a sign that said, 51 years together, 1 year married. But they, you know, they talked about, you know, marching in the first prides and teachers wearing bags over their heads and being, mm-hmm. you know, having people throwing tomatoes at them and, you know, having their house vandalized and reporting it to the cops, and the cops just laughed in their face. And so it was, you know, it just being mindful of where we've come from and where we're going and what the vision is, helped, deal with, it helped make setbacks seem more like, you know, transitory things rather than, you know, this is the end.
Mm-hmm. Actually listening to you and reflecting on, you know, some of the people in Real Change, I keep thinking that loving kindness for oneself, and not just for oneself, but, you know, to have that kind of self-respect is like an essential ingredient in being able to work in a movement for change, because you know, the world may be telling you you're not worth much, or you're not equal, or you're not as good, or whatever. And maybe they've been telling you that for 51 years, but there's something in you that has to know that's not true.
Yeah.
And I have the right, which is not an egotistical statement, you know, but I have the right to be treated with the dignity that is actually part of my being, because it's part of everyone's being. And it's a not often articulated, if ever articulated, aspect of a movement.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. And I remember the, you know, thinking about the Buddha's teaching that, you know, that you yourself are as deserving of, of worth and love as anybody else. Basically no more deserving, but certainly no less deserving. That was, you know, I remember just sitting with that and thinking about it, like, my God, is that really possible to be true? That, it's, I think for lots of people who, you know, who are born into a disadvantaged group, or who, you know, who have tough family experiences, it's, that's a powerful, notion.
I was just looking over, not too long ago, the transcript of the talk that the Dalai Lama gave in the meditation hall at the Insight Meditation Society. He came to visit in 1979, and we were, of course, young, and, he was coming to Amherst at Bob Thurman's invitation, who was then at Amherst College, and Amherst is, you know, like 40 minutes away from Barry. So we wrote the private office a letter. We said, "Hey, we're a Buddhist center too. Does he want to come here?" Mm-hmm. And we got back a letter saying, "Yes, he'll come." Wow. So amazing. That was outrageous. And we had, you may remember the bowling alley, the bowling lane. Yep. We have a one lane bowling alley in the basement of the center, because when we bought it, it was a Catholic novitiate, and so there were a lot of kind of social amenities there. And we actually had we inherited from the fathers of the Blessed Sacrament a room full of bowling shoes, and you know, so when the Dalai Lama came, it was still functioning, and he did roll a ball. So everyone asked me, like, "How'd he do?" And I said, "I don't remember." You know, I was like so freaked out. But then he came into the meditation hall and he gave a talk. And in the question period that followed, so we had a retreat. Maybe it had been going on for 2 weeks at that point. Because somebody raised his hand and said, "I've been meditating for 2 weeks and I don't think I can do it. I'm just like incredibly discouraged. I think I don't have the capacity to develop wisdom. I just can't do it." And I think this was the Dalai Lama's first trip to North America, actually. And he just looked really surprised and a little bit confused. And then he said, "Well, you're just wrong." "You're just wrong." And he went on, you know, to describe what they believe would be the innate capacity every single human being has for growth and change and wisdom and love. And but it was such a kind of startling moment. Like, "Well, you're just wrong." Like, forget that point of view, you know.
I love that. That's, yeah, that's so true. It's easy to forget. Very easy to forget.
So, you know, I'm wondering about sort of, you've now interlaced loving kindness practice, in particular loving kindness practice or meditation, in with your activism, and it would seem like it's a very nourishing part of that.
It is, without a doubt. I think for me, it's both to connect with other advocates on my side of the issue, and you know, instead of you know, and having some gentleness and compassion, and instead of sort of going with my first thought of that's a terrible idea, that'll, you know, that'll cause us to lose, that'll, you know, it's modulating that and recognizing that these are, you know, good people who are trying to, you know, who are fighting for the same cause I am. And then I think even more profoundly, it's when in making the case to others. I mean, one of the real strengths of the marriage movement is that we grew from, 20-some-odd% support nationally in 1996 to today we're close to 70%. And that was a lot of changing of hearts and minds. And core to that work was figuring out how to connect to people that weren't with us. And it takes a lot of restraint and, sort of gentleness to look at somebody who is not with you or who, and I'm generally not talking about the people who are just vociferous opponents, because we didn't need everybody and we didn't have to like try to convince, the most sort of fundamentalist religious believer. But there were plenty of people in the middle who were like, you know, I know some gay people. I think they're fine people. But why do they need to call it marriage? And why can't they call it something else? And, I'm really conflicted because, I have a family member who's gay and I know her partner. But I also grew up in the Catholic faith. And I know that the Catholic faith taught me this about gay people. And so it's helping. I mean, so responding to people and saying, well, you know what, you're opposed to us, you're a bigot, shuts down the conversation quickly and people get defensive and back up and it doesn't move the ball forward. It's hard work. It's hard work, emotionally to ask people to really think about what's truly important to themselves. And a big part of our work was educating straight people about who same-sex couples were. A lot of people had these notions in their mind that, that gay people were sort of people, huge partiers who only lived in Greenwich Village and San Francisco. And, everybody dresses up and goes to pride parades. And, there are plenty of folks that do that, including myself, but it's all, there are also, this very significant, percentage of people who are partnered, who are living in a loving and committed relationship. And, people just didn't know that. Mm-hmm. So it was really opening, helping people understand who same-sex couples were, and then connecting to them, like helping straight people see that, that our relationships are really not different from theirs, that our love and commitment is similar, that we want to marry for the same reasons, and that they may have conflicts in their, like everybody has conflicts in their belief system, that somebody can be an observant person and have been taught that homosexuality is wrong, but then you ask them, like, what's most fundamental about your religious teachings, and usually people say some version of treat others the way you want to be treated, the golden rule. Mm-hmm. So it's like and giving people permission to evolve and to move our way took plenty of empathy on our parts and gentleness and not letting the anger get in the, front of things. So it's hard.
It is. I remember I saw the movie about Harvey Milk. I don't know how many times it felt like every friend that I was hanging out with wanted to see it separately. Yeah. So I went like a lot of times, and which was, fortunately, I really thought it was a good movie. But there was this line in there when they faced some kind of defeat in some campaign or another, and he said to his group, everybody has to come out. And I thought, what an incredible statement, because how we declare the other, who is the other?
Yeah.
And, you know, we have that sense of separation because they are so different. But like, what about if it is my cousin, you know? And what about, like, what is this division that is just a construct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what the movements that I've been involved in are largely about, human rights. And that's, you know, that's really what human rights movements are about. And, you know, so I've more recently done work with, as you mentioned before, with people who have been convicted of felonies.
Mm-hmm,
So, you know, the division in a lot of people's minds about, well, what is, you know, these people are different. These people are the other. These people did something bad and something that I haven't done. And so part of it is helping people break it down to understand, you know, what a felony is. But, you know, and then helping people listen to some of the stories of these folks, and that they aren't the other, that, you know, somebody gets hooked on drugs and then robs something. And does that mean they shouldn't be able to vote ever again? It's the same, you know, I do a lot of work with undocumented immigrants, and it's the same, same situation. Like there, it's like, well, these people are illegals, and it's like, what does that mean? And it's, they're actually human beings who are, you know, in the climate we're all living in these days, human beings who are doing the essential services of your food and growing your food and helping you out when you get to the hospital and all of that. And so they're, you know, that is a lot of the work that I do. And it definitely syncs up with, you know, with the practice of loving kindness at its roots.
What do you find really effective ways? Is it hearing the stories? Is it seeing the stories? Is it meeting the people, of dissolving that sense of otherness? You know, like, it's hard for me to say, because in each of those instances, well, with undocumented immigrants, for example, you know, I felt really in accord with a lot of movements, you know, like IJINPU and domestic workers. And but it was actually when I was in the hospital like a year and a half ago in California. And then when I came out, I was staying with these friends, and I had 24-hour home health aides. And hearing their stories, which was also somewhat in this book, you know, it was a whole other kind of acquaintance, you know, people coming to the night shift because they were working another job all day, you know, or taking their father to dialysis, or, you know, and I never knew their immigration status unless something happened, like I asked you if a driver's license or something, you know, you know, it was totally irrelevant. But I thought, wow, you know, look what these people are doing for me, you know. And it was a whole other level of appreciation.
I think that is crucial, the notion of having people like that in your life, to understand who they are and what makes, you know, who they are, what makes them tick, and the fact that we're all sort of in this together. It can be challenging in the abstract. Like, you know, on back to marriage equality, it was, you know, we talked to certain people, and, you know, who weren't with us on marriage equality or LGBT equality. And they'd talk about the other, and then they'd be, oh, except for that nice guy, you know, my friend's son who just came out, he's the sweetest kid in the world. And I'd want, well, should he be able to get married? And they're like, well, maybe, but so I think one of our core strategies, and that is why Harvey Milk, who is one of my heroes, said, you know, you need to come out, because if we are the unknown, then people have, you know, people can develop images of who the entirety of the LGBT community is, that is really inaccurate. And, and so I think it's, on other movements, it's also something similar. It's figuring out how do you get people to connect? And often mm-hmm. that means you aren't trying to get them to a place way far from where they're starting. It's like, how do you get them to take two steps towards you because they know somebody like you and realize that you're a decent human being. And that's always been my approach to change, is that people don't sort of revolutionize themselves too often. It's how do you get them to think about the person who's taking care of their kids or taking care of their house and try to extrapolate a little bit from that without turning them into sort of social radicals. It's something you stress a lot in your writing. It's about figuring out ways to connect, and mm-hmm. the more you connect, the more you break down barriers, and the more you're able to expand your circle of people who are, you know, who you care about beyond yourself and your family and inner circle of people.
But given that, you know, I've been to a few prisons to teach, and not everybody is going to have that experience. Like, I went to a women's prison, and I swear every single woman in there was there because of a relationship. Hmm. You know, guy said, "Oh, would you just drive the car, you know, while I wait outside while I rob the bank or something," you know, and it was kind of extraordinary. And I was in another prison once where it was a men's prison. It was much more short term in terms of how long people were there. And the staff was much more problematic. I did a program for the staff after I did a program for the prisoners, and staff was much more difficult, actually, you know?
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, no doubt suffering a lot, and it would be interesting to have a program for them, but not everyone's going to go into a prison. And so, do you use media? Like, how do you approach that sense of connection?
A lot of media, for sure. In Florida, on this ballot campaign that I worked on, Florida was one of the very few states where if you were convicted of a felony, you were barred from voting forever. And so it was, in some ways it was similar to to some of the work on LGBT equality, in that about 10% of Floridians have been convicted of a felony, and we needed people to come out as ex-felons, as someone who was convicted of a felony, mm-hmm. because everybody knew somebody who had been convicted of a felony, who had, driven with a suspended driver's license when they were 21, or who, you know, there are all sorts of things that were felonies. So that was a part of it. But then it was also using the media, using paid TV commercials with especially poignant stories that help connect, that help as many people as possible connect to who these folks are. It's often people who have done things for their country and yet made a mistake, people who, you know, a guy who has a Purple Heart from Vietnam, who then came back and was depressed and, you know, sold marijuana for, you know, and now he's barred from voting for the rest of his life. And so it's finding stories that people can get in their guts. Like, oh my God, uh-huh. If I'd been in Vietnam, maybe, you know, I listen to this guy. I can see and hear what he was going through, and I could have made that same mistake myself. And of course, this person who has a Purple Heart and fought for this country shouldn't be barred from voting. Mm-hmm. It's finding ways, you know, as you were saying, separate from being able to introduce everybody to somebody. It's being able to take mm-hmm. the most poignant, some of the most poignant stories, and figure out ways to to bring them to people.
It's incredible work. And I think it so strongly reflects what I've always felt like. Well, if you ask the people who say that the most salient feature of their religion is love thy neighbor as thyself, whether they believed imprisonment was for rehabilitation or for punishment, I bet a lot of them might say rehabilitation, you know, but yeah. Then what does that look like then?
Right. Yeah, totally. Totally.
So I want to talk to you about a political cause that is very dear to my heart, which is voting. In my mind, the emphasis on everybody voting, I mean, look at this miracle that you can vote. You haven't been barred from it because of a mistake you made when you were 18 or something. But as much as people try to keep that right to vote from people, it seems to me that it so deeply reflects the Buddhist teaching on the inherent worth of everybody. And some of these people complain about my fixation on urging people to vote. So I'm going to do it again. I once was doing a program on mindfulness with Tim Ryan, the congressman, and we were in Washington, D.C., and it was all about mindfulness. I just kept talking about voting. And finally, Tim turned to me and said, "Are you running for office?" I said, "No, but you are."
I'll be your campaign manager, Sharon, if you don't.
Thank you. Somebody, my friend Shelley, who is a fireball of energy, wanted to start a campaign about kindness, vote in kindness. And she made these t-shirts that said Sharon 2020. I'll tell her I have a campaign manager now. I think it is such a spiritual act. I think it's a sacred act. And I feel pained when I hear people are barred from voting or because of the manipulation, so many people can't vote, or they wait 8 hours in the rain or something like that, you know, because I do think it's a sacred act. I do think it's so deeply reflective of the fact that we have worth. We should have a voice, whoever we are, and even whoever we're going to vote for, you know?
Yeah.
That it's so important that people honor that and get engaged.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. It was, I certainly learned a lot about the value of voting and the importance of being able to vote and the meaning of it during that campaign I was talking about in Florida, where people who had made a mistake were barred from voting for the rest of their lives, and what that meant to them, and you know what it meant to them as a citizen, and as a was this notion that they were less than for the rest of their lives. They couldn't get a second chance. I think the notion of, you know, so many efforts try to make it harder for people to vote are just so depressing. It's actually one of the things I in this period of time, pre-election, I'm spending a lot of time working with big cities in particular and helping them ensure that they are ready to have robust elections in November, that they can recruit enough poll workers even in this time of pandemic, so that you don't end up with 8 hour long lines in places like Atlanta or Milwaukee, and that you can vote early and you don't have to, you know, if you have a job that doesn't let you take off on election day, you can vote over the weekend before, and voting should be something that is really simple to do. The notion of people who are trying to make it harder is just, they've got some internal work to do.
You are a good person. And on that note, would you like to close this conversation? Although it's so great to talk to you, would you like to close it by leading a practice?
Sure. I, as we've talked about, I do have a meta practice, and I'm like probably like many practitioners, I have phases where I do it a lot and phases where I do it a little. But even just the knowledge that it's there is a great comfort, and I try to do it more than not do it. But why don't we just sit and do a basic loving kindness meditation to ourselves and to other beings, and so we can sit and close our eyes and think about why we each deserve to be loved. And the phrases that I use are as follows, and people can follow along with the phrases that they have used. But I say, may I be free. May I be safe and protected. May I be filled with love. And may I dwell in peace. May I be free. May I be safe and protected. May I be filled with love. And may I dwell in peace. And then to think about the world that we inhabit and the furthest stretch that we can go. I often end my meditation with wishing those same feelings and thoughts really to all living beings. May all living beings, including myself, be free. May all living beings be safe and protected. May all living beings be filled with love. May all living beings dwell in peace. Well, thank you, Sharon, for having me on. It was a real honor.
Well, thank you. So delightful to connect with you again. And thank you all for joining us. To learn more about Mark's work, you can visit www.civitaspublicaffairs.com. That's CIVITASPUBLICAFFAIRS.com. This has been the Real Change series on the Metta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, be happy, be healthy, and live with ease.
Hey, folks, thanks for listening. Real Change is available September 1st in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook formats. Learn more at realchangebook.com.